Well, it's really a pleasure to be here with all of you, and thank you for coming and reflecting on this question, which I think is actually a very important question. In January, we'll be celebrating Martin Luther King Day, of course, and Martin Luther King is rightly viewed as a great hero of our modern American history. I think we're right to be proud of the movement that he led and of the accomplishments of the civil rights movement. And it represents a kind of shining moment in recent American history for standing up for justice and actually the triumph of justice. But what I'd like to do this evening is to examine, in a way, the principles that Dr. King was building his case on. And if we understand them in the way that he himself understood the crusade for justice that he engaged in, and when we take them at face value, it's rather surprising what you find. And as I will be presenting it, actually, there are deep Christian and even Catholic themes that are present there. And I would say they're not just side themes, but the central principles on which he's building his case. So there was a handout I think most of you picked it up when you came in. It's excerpts from Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, which is what I'd like to, you know, sort of walk through a little bit and talk about as we go forward. And maybe a few little introductory points just to set in context the other remarks that I'm going to make. They're often, it's sort of obvious from the text itself, but not that often remarked on. The first is that he's writing as a Christian minister to other Christian ministers. And that's in the very opening salutation, "My dear fellow clergymen." That is, the context for King's movement and for the arguments he's making, that context is explicitly religious and, in fact, explicitly Christian. Now, that does not mean that he's making explicitly theological or religious arguments themselves. In fact, I think he's consciously trying to make arguments that, while rooted in the Christian tradition and growing out of it, are accessible to all and that don't, in fact, require you to accept the Christian faith in order to hear the arguments or to be persuaded by them. The second point of context, it's 1963. He's writing in the aftermath, not that long after the end of the Second World War, the struggle against the Nazis, and in the middle of the struggle against Soviet communism. 5 years earlier, and he refers to both of those things in his letter, as you'll see. 5 years earlier, in 1956, was the Hungarian uprising. That was a popular revolt by freedom fighters in Hungary against their Soviet communist masters. It only lasted 19 days, and then it was crushed by Russian tanks in October of 1956. And Martin Luther King makes reference to this as an example of the principle that citizens should be able to reject unjust laws when they are imposed upon them. And that was something that was very persuasive to an American audience in 1963, that the Hungarian people had a right to overthrow or to get out from under the oppression of Soviet communism. So he and his listeners were acutely aware of what you might say is now even more pointedly presented to us in our contemporary political circumstance, that Western democratic government is not an inevitable form of government and is not immune also from abuses. And that there's a real question about how people may need to fight for justice in the face of what might be a really oppressive regime. So the obvious examples, Nazi Germany and communist Hungary. But the following question then, could this happen here in the United States? Is there something like this that Americans even would be prone to doing? The third point of context for King's letter is intellectual, the Western tradition of reflection on law, justice, politics, and morality. And that's really what I'm going to be developing and highlighting this evening. So let's look at Martin Luther King's text and maybe start off at the last two paragraphs. Really, it's the last paragraph that I've excerpted for you here. But the second to last paragraph, with the letter C next to it, says, "Of course, there's nothing new about this kind of civil disobedience." He's talking, of course, about the civil disobedience that he and his fellow protesters were engaging in Birmingham, Alabama, rejecting the Jim Crow segregation regime that was enshrined in law. But skip to the last paragraph. "We can never forget that everything Hitler did in Germany was legal, and everything the Hungarian freedom fighters did in Hungary was illegal. It was illegal to aid and comfort a Jew in Hitler's Germany. But I am sure that if I had lived in Germany during that time, I would have aided and comforted my Jewish brothers, even though it was illegal. If I lived in a communist country today, where certain principles dear to the Christian faith are suppressed, I believe I would openly advocate disobeying these anti-religious laws." So this raises, it seems to me, what we could call the question of illegal laws or unjust laws. The question could be framed this way. It is possible, and we see that it sometimes does happen in totalitarian states like Nazi Germany or Communist Hungary, but even perhaps also in democratic societies like the United States in the early 1960s, it's possible that there will be laws that make something illegal that should be legal, and vice versa. Okay, now that's a very basic and maybe obvious starting point. And on one level, framing it just in that very neutral way might seem to you kind of strange or even, you know, silly to start with that. Isn't it a truism that what the law decrees is legal and what it forbids is illegal? Can there be an illegal law, as it were? And the answer to that, of course, depends on what you mean by a law. If you accept what the legal philosophy called legal positivism would hold, that whatever is legal is simply what is duly enacted by the proper authority, then you would have to say that everything that the positive law says is legal, and everything that it forbids is illegal. Now, you could immediately want to begin talking about the question of justice and whether a law is just or unjust, but stay for a moment with this issue of legality, because actually I think this is clarifying and it's helpful. We can imagine a situation where a local law conflicts with some higher law, like the law of Birmingham, Alabama, conflicting with a federal statutory law, or with the U.S. constitutional law. And often in the American system, we're used to talking about things in exactly this way. We would say, well, the segregation statutes are unconstitutional, and therefore they have to be struck down. Now, there's nothing wrong with analyzing it in that way, but notice what we are talking about. We are talking about two different positive laws. That is, a positive law is a law affirmatively enacted by some legislative authority. So the U.S. Constitution is a positive law. It's a kind of fundamental positive law enacted a long time ago in a kind of extraordinary way. It requires a supermajority to change the Constitution, but it is a form of positive law. So the U.S. Constitution is a much more fundamental positive law than the local statutes in Birmingham, Alabama. But you could be a pure legal positivist and say the Constitution trumps Alabama's statutes. Okay. The reason I wanted to highlight this is most Americans typically think along exactly these lines. They think that the Constitution is the ultimate norm for what is legal and what is illegal. And that is useful as far as it goes, but it doesn't necessarily go far enough, because it would be consistent with that view to be a committed, what we can call a committed legal positivist. That is, that whatever the duly constituted governing authority decrees is the law, and that there is no recourse beyond that. That there is no higher law or unwritten law, moral law or natural law, that is concrete enough to make a judgment about. So even if we might admit that there's some kind of general moral law out there, it's too vague, too vacuous to consider. It's not properly a law that binds you. What I'd like to suggest is that Dr. King is taking issue with precisely this understanding of law, a kind of strong legal positivism. He's making a much more robust claim than most Americans typically make when they talk about issues of discrimination, for example. Because in 1963, the U.S. Constitution did not forbid segregation, or at least had not been so interpreted. And we should not forget that there were provisions in the U.S. Constitution before its amendment after the Civil War, which positively protected slavery, enshrined racial discrimination in the Constitution itself. So Dr. King is aware of the fragility of relying on the positive law to be the ultimate safeguard of justice. He thinks there needs to be a stronger claim out there. So this is brings us to quotation A. That's the second paragraph on your handout, where he is making a claim not just about the positive law, but about something higher than the positive law. He writes, "You express a great deal of anxiety over our willingness to break laws." And skipping a little bit, "One may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer is found in the fact that there are two types of laws. There are just and there are unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all." This is a very different kind of claim than a legal positivist would make. For a legal positivist, or for a sociologist, for example, you decide what is a law simply by looking at the procedures used to enact the law. Whatever is duly enacted, or whatever the people respect as if it were duly enacted, that is what we say is the law. But if we agree with Martin Luther King that some laws can be unjust, then we would be agreeing that unjust laws are parasitic. They take advantage of the category of law to perpetuate what is actually opposed to the principles of law. That is why he says an unjust law is no law at all. There is some category of law that requires it to be just, to be truly a law. And you cannot simply determine that by looking at just whatever the legislature enacts by following the right procedure. It requires a different kind of inquiry to decide whether the law is just or unjust. In other words, part of the purpose of law is to order society according to justice. And that is a very important first principle for the deep and long Western tradition, you might say the Christian tradition, about understanding the law, in which St. Augustine's quote, or from which St. Augustine's quote, emerges. So let's go further with Dr. King's text. This is text B now, the third paragraph on this excerpt. Now, what is the difference between the two? How does one determine when a law is just or unjust? A just law, he writes, is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal and natural law. Now, Dr. King here cites St. Thomas Aquinas, and here I can speak with some real authority, having spent many years reading St. Thomas Aquinas. So I'd like to offer you now some background in what Aquinas says about law in order to understand this point that Martin Luther King is making. First of all, now maybe I don't need to do it with this audience, but just a brief introduction. Who was Thomas Aquinas? Thomas Aquinas was a medieval Dominican friar, a member of my own Dominican order, so it's part of the reason that Father Albert and I are so proud of Aquinas. He's one of our own. He's also one of the great figures in the tradition of Western philosophy and theology. He made a major contribution in many different areas, including the philosophy of law. And he offers a quite different approach to what is sometimes called natural law than is encountered in a lot of other writings, and that's why I think it's helpful to listen to Aquinas without filtering him through, for example, the Enlightenment thinkers like Thomas Hobbes or John Locke, who also spoke a lot about natural law, but meaning something actually very different from Aquinas. This is one of the difficulties when you use the catchphrase or the label natural law, is that in fact it means very different things to different traditions, and so in a certain sense it can be confusing unless you know exactly what you're talking about. But actually, when you look at Aquinas, he is light years away from Hobbes or Locke, and his account is much easier to understand than you might think. And he's the one that Martin Luther King is explicitly citing, so I'd like to do a little bit of work to try and present to you the key ideas or kind of introduction to Aquinas on this theory of law and natural law. So, very simple examples are the best way to get some purchase on this idea. Suppose you were running a farm, say it's an apple farm, and you want to raise good apples. Now, if you didn't know anything at all about apple farming, you would begin by paying attention to what leads your trees to flourish, what gives you a good crop of apples. Of course, you want the apples to look good, to taste good, to be sufficiently durable, to yield a sufficient crop every year, and so forth. So you might experiment with different ways of fertilizing the trees or different ways of pruning them, different times of harvesting and so forth, planting them in different locations with more or less sunlight. You get the point. Over years of experience, you might have a kind of practical wisdom about what makes apple trees flourish. And in fact, this isn't that much different from what modern agricultural science does in trying to study how to get a high-yield crop. Okay, so you have to know something about the apple tree and what makes an apple tree produce good apples in order to have an idea of how to raise good apple trees, right? Now, suppose you make it a little bit more complex. Suppose you're a sheep farmer and you want to raise good wool. Sheep are more complicated creatures than apple trees. There are more variables. But your goal is to produce goodwill. You'll go through the same sort of thing to come up with your sort of practical wisdom, rules for how to pasture a good flock of sheep. Okay, now let's make it something more complicated again. Suppose you're trying to win, raise championship-winning show horses, like these horses that jump over the obstacles that you can watch on ESPN sometime, you know. That requires a lot more sophistication, because here you not only have to have a well-bred horse, but you have to have a well-trained horse, and actually a very well-trained horse. A lot of training goes into raising horses like that, and in fact, there is even a social dimension to the lives of horses. Horses have personalities. They can be influenced by the other horses. If you have a particularly ill-behaved horse, it can be disruptive. So the rules that you would need to follow to train championship show horses are more complicated. But in each of these cases, the point of talking about these examples is to see how practical experience, observing the sort of thing you're dealing with, will produce real knowledge about how to make good apples, good sheep, good horses. And this is where you begin to see the connection with law in Aquinas' mind. This is actually what Aquinas is talking about when he's talking about natural law. So it's a normal way for us even to think about ourselves. If you want to be a good marathon runner, here are the practical tips of the things that you need to do. If you want to be a successful student and overcome the temptations to procrastination, I'm sure no one here has ever faced anything like that, here are some tips for how to change your study habits. These are kind of practical wisdom that allows you to realize more the potential that you have to be a good student or a good marathon runner. Aquinas thinks that law actually functions very much in this way. That is, we typically are ready to think of law as a kind of commandment handed down by an authority demanding obedience. But Aquinas does not define law in those terms. Listen to his famous definition of law. Law is an ordination of reason for the common good made by one who has care of the community, which is promulgated. Okay, so what are the essential elements here? It is for the common good. Law aims at the good of the human community. It's like aiming at the good of a grove of apple trees, or a good of the flock of sheep, or the good of the horses. Now, of course, a human community is much more complex than any of those things. What does make a flourishing human community? That's a very important question. It's not an easy question to answer. We can give certain parameters to the answer. Some things are obvious. Some things are much more debatable. The point, though, is that the law is concerned with developing a good community. That's what it's aiming at. It aims at the common good. And that's something that we can deliberate about using the power of reason. So law is an ordination of reason for the common good. Okay, this second element, an ordination of reason, is also very important. Because we as human beings have the capacity to observe and understand the world around us. And therefore, to tailor our activity towards what we perceive to be good. So law arises when someone with care of the community deliberates about what is really good for the community and promulgates an ordination of reason in order to achieve it. That is what Aquinas thinks is happening when you have a law. So law is not fundamentally about obedience or obligation or command. Law is fundamentally about aiming at the good and coordinating activity so that the community can achieve its good. What then is natural law, according to Aquinas? Or better, I think, maybe the law of nature. Aquinas thinks that we come to know the law of nature when we use the power of our reason, the power of our minds, to look at what kind of beings we are, to examine what leads to a flourishing human life and flourishing human communities, and then using our reason to order our communal life according to this knowledge. So that's not a terribly complicated idea, and actually that is really all Aquinas means when he talks about natural law. And he thinks that given the kind of beings that we are, there are certain fundamental things that will always need to be there if you're going to have a flourishing human community. For example, you can't be killing innocent people, right? So you have to outlaw murder. You have to have a kind of general respect for private property. So stealing, in most circumstances, absent grave need in kind of national emergency kind of situation, stealing is also wrong. So you can build kind of fundamental precepts around what it takes to have a flourishing human community. And Aquinas thinks you can arrive at that simply by looking at the nature of human beings and the nature of human communities and observing them and using your mind to judge what is good about them. And that is going to hold true in many different, all different circumstances in which you find human beings, because it says something about the essence of the human being as a rational animal who wants to live in community with each other. Okay, what then is the function of the positive law, according to Aquinas? So Aquinas recognizes there is an enormous diversity of human cultures and of historical circumstances, and therefore a wide scope of possibilities for human flourishing. So what Providence, Rhode Island needs to have a flourishing community may be rather different than what you need in California, simply by virtue of the climate, for example. You know, Providence is probably going to have more rules about cleaning the snow off your sidewalk than, Los Angeles is going to have. You don't need that in Los Angeles. The positive law is actually very important for human society. Its function is to order and direct this particular community towards its good, given its own particular circumstances. In other words, the positive law's function is to make specific judgments for this community here and now about the good. So, this leads us to some conclusions about law and the relationship between law, justice, and morality in light of Martin Luther King and Thomas Aquinas. So, a whole lot could be said here, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to present you with kind of short summary of how to understand these two together. The first point, and I think the most important point, which you get clearly in Martin Luther King, but you also get very clearly in Thomas Aquinas, is that you cannot simply appeal to the positive law or to legal positivism to answer the most difficult questions about justice and morality. It's not simply the case that because a law is duly enacted, that it is just. Aquinas recognizes that there are some basic things that the positive law must acknowledge, must protect, like the value of human life. And that when the positive law contravenes those basic principles of justice, it should not have a binding force on us. Why? Because it has betrayed its function. Its function is precisely to order the community towards its good. When the positive law does not order the community towards its good, it is not functioning the way it ought. And in grave cases, then, it can even be disobeyed. Certainly, it is grounds to change the positive law when you see that it's not accomplishing that good. Notice that even for Aquinas, and also I think for Martin Luther King, you do not have to appeal here to some law of God written on a tablet in heaven. That is sometimes what people think. Christians especially, I mean, when a Christian especially makes an appeal to natural law, often people hear or think that what is being said is there is some kind of moral law that God has established in heaven, and we need to use that, we need to simply enact that for our community. And they're nervous about that, especially because they feel like, you know, maybe Bible-based morality has been oppressive in some contexts or so forth. I mean, you are familiar with the critique. Aquinas's point here is not that the higher moral law is simply what God has decreed. Rather, God has created human beings according to a certain order, a kind of plan that is observable in the world around us, that certain things are necessary for a flourishing human community. And so even before we make an appeal to divine revelation, we can already begin to figure out what belongs to the natural law, a law instituted, of course, by God when he created the world and created human beings as he did. But it isn't simply a matter of some kind of divine revelation telling us what that law is. Is that clear? The second sort of concluding point or summary point is that the standards that our minds discover about what is really just and what is unjust, these are not, according to Aquinas, the result of our thinking about them. Our minds are not creating the principles of justice. Rather, according to Aquinas, we discover something that is already sown into the very nature of the world around us. It's very much like what makes an apple tree flourish, but it's what makes a human being flourish, or what makes a human community flourish. The principles of justice are actually principles of the real order, the real world around us. They are really there. And they're important questions. Questions, by the way, that cannot simply be answered by a scientific inquiry or a sociological inquiry. It requires a kind of reflective, you might say, moral or philosophical inquiry to discern what these principles are. Just a very simple example of this. Science can give us the technical expertise to build a nuclear bomb. But there is no scientific experiment we can run to tell us if it is wrong to drop it on a city. That is an extremely important question to answer. Is that just or unjust? But it is not one that a scientific experiment can give you the answer to. So there is a domain, a very important domain, of human inquiry that requires this kind of moral reflection. And it doesn't have to refer to divine revelation, although I think divine revelation is a big help here. But it doesn't have to refer to divine revelation in order to discern some principles of justice in the world around us. So in the end, then, for Aquinas and for Martin Luther King, law is an authentic law, a true law, when it orders our lives towards the authentic good of the human person. And that is exactly what Martin Luther King defines in his letter from a Birmingham jail. When law destroys the human person, it is an unjust law. When it is ordered to the flourishing of the human person, then we may well be talking about something that is a just law. But a final conclusion here. Law, justice, and even morality, this is something that most people do not understand, even morality, these are not simply matters of obligation and authority, handing down commands. These are about directing our lives to the good. And that is a very important thing for us to recover, I think, for our political system. To recognize that it is an inevitable and important part of our common life together, that we deliberate about what is really good for our community, what is just for our community, and that we do so by a reasoned exchange. One of the dangers of losing sight of law as an ordination of reason, when you begin to think of law as simply a command handed down by a superior authority, you can then begin to think that law is simply an instrument of power politics. And is not that part of the crisis that we have in our politics now? That debates are understood principally in terms of one group enforcing its will on another, rather than a deliberation by the community about what is really good for us as a community. Now, maybe it's very hard for us to recover that dimension in our politics, but that is Aquinas' understanding of the purpose of law and the purpose of the political community. And I think it's also Martin Luther King's ideal for how to frame just laws. So with that, why don't I conclude, and I hope that you will have questions or even objections, which are certainly welcome. But I'd love to have a discussion about this. So thank you very much for your attention, and open the floor to your comments. Yeah.
So thank you for the talk. One of the things that I'm trying to think through is if, I understand that, law should be ordered towards the good, right? But is there a hierarchy of goods? If you look at it in a negative perspective, would it be ever acceptable to enact an unjust law in order to prevent a greater injustice? Or on the positive side, a law that achieves a greater good while sacrificing a lesser good?
So there are some cases where you have to weigh competing goods. I mean, that's going to be inevitable. And Aquinas would say there are certain things that are really obvious that the community really always has to respect, like protecting innocent life. So he would say, if you don't protect innocent life, that's a fundamental failure of justice. Or if you actually sponsor the direct killing of innocent human life, that's a grave injustice. Okay, so that's pretty obvious, and at least in general, most people agree with that. As you try to get more specific, if you're making a claim based on natural law, it gets harder and harder to prove your case, as it were, Aquinas thinks. He thinks that the general principles of the natural law remain pretty general. So they don't specify in great detail the difficult cases and there can be lots of diversity in the ways that a community actually specifies the principles of justice in its particular law. So natural law is very useful as a kind of check against grave abuse, but it isn't so directly helpful when you're trying to specify what needs to be the rule for this community. And there you have to weigh competing goods. I mean, to just use this is like a medieval example, but it's still a real example. I lived in Switzerland for almost 4 years in a city which still has medieval walls. And at 10:07 every night, the cathedral bells ring to signal that the city gates are closing. Now, they don't actually close the gates anymore, but suppose that they did. I mean, the point of that was to secure the city for the night, right? But it does affect, like, commerce, you know? People who want to come into the city to go to the inn can't get in or can't leave after that hour. So it works effectively as a kind of curfew, which curtails some good activity. But that's So, yes, you're going to have to weigh those things. And we can come up with lots and lots of other modern examples of the kinds of laws that we have that, that deal with that. You know, maybe you're going to say, you know, here in Providence, you're going to restrict parking or traffic on certain streets for water fire. And, you know, that's to enable the community to have a kind of civic, you know, civic celebration there. And that's a good thing. But if you lived on one of those streets, you might say, hey, actually, this is not such a good thing. I'm not such a fan of water fire anymore. I'm tired of all the traffic or whatever it is, you know. So, yes, the law is always going to have to be dealing with those competing goods. But that's a part of the deliberation about what really belongs to the common good of the community. Yeah.
You used deliberate several times. And it seems to me that we don't deliberate very well anymore. It seems to me every year it gets worse. And I don't know if this last election is an example of how broken we are, or there's just so much divisiveness that it seems we can't deliberate. So I don't know if how to turn that into a question. It's like, are you optimistic that we can recover the ability to deliberate? Because it seems to me that we can't even spell it anymore.
Yeah, I think, a serious challenge. Now, here from the Catholic tradition, I would appeal to an important principle of Catholic social teaching, which is subsidiarity. Another word that's hard to spell and sounds very abstract, but it's actually not that abstract. It's basically the principle that local questions should be decided by local decision makers. So keep it local. I mean, the buy local phenomenon, you know, to buy from local producers, is like the commercial equivalent of subsidiarity. But the idea is, if a decision can be made by your, you know, by your neighborhood council, it shouldn't be decided by the state legislature. And it certainly shouldn't be decided by the federal government. Because once you bump it up to that level, it's much harder to respect local differences, and it's much harder for individual people to have a voice in what legitimately affects them. So that has been one of the, you know, kind of big picture changes in American governance over the history of the U.S. So we've had a few moments where there's been a dramatic centralization of authority, sometimes in response to abuses. I mean, the Civil Rights Act would be an example of this. You had local laws which were really unjust. And that was part of the problem, is that the local, I mean, what Martin Luther King, what was he confronting in Alabama? He was not confronting a very vocal minority. He was, in fact, confronting the majority of voters. So it was the democratic process itself that had put the segregation laws into the books. And it wasn't clear that you could get a democratic majority to overturn them on the local level, which is why they then appealed to the higher authority, and you get an act of Congress. Now, Martin Luther King's point was, actually, you can appeal to an unwritten higher law to say that this local law is unjust and we should disobey it. And, of course, he's trying to get it changed. I mean, he was trying to mobilize political opinion, and he did succeed in doing that, although not without a great deal of suffering. But, you know, so there is that danger with, you know, having things at a local level. But simply moving it to a higher level does not guarantee you that you're going to be immune from injustice. You know, so Congress can make an unjust law, too, and they've made plenty of unjust laws in the history of our country, unfortunately. In general, it's going to be a healthier political system if citizens on the local level have real control over local issues. And that's a long-standing principle of Catholic social doctrine, which was enunciated by Leo XIII in his encyclical Rerum Novarum, which is considered a kind of the origin of modern Catholic social doctrine in the 19th century, late 19th century. Yes.
I thank you for your talk, Father. I'm wondering, what about when a principle of the natural law, and so you mentioned like the preservation of innocent life, what happens, what do we do when that same principle is sort of co-opted by or maybe justly claimed by both sides? Take, for example, questions of immigration, right? And
yeah.
And so you have one side saying, well, to protect innocent lives already in the country, we need to put greater limitations on immigration. On the other side, we say to protect innocent lives that are fleeing for their lives, we need to be more flexible and take in more refugees, take in more migrants. What do we do? How do we approach those moments where the same principle is being claimed?
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say two things in response to that. One is about the question about where, sort of directly what you're asking, where you have a principle that maybe is being argued for on both sides. The other is about the question of what is the political community, you know, because is it the whole world or is it, like, is it legitimate to have a local community? So that's also a very interesting and I think important question to answer. But the first question, I think, you know, when you're talking about protecting innocent life, there Aquinas would recognize a difference between negative prohibitions and positive commandments, as it were, positive enactments. Okay, what is the classic distinction between these is this, that negative prohibitions, thou shalt not kill, right, you know, or never kill an innocent human life, that applies always and everywhere. So there are no circumstances where it is legitimate to directly kill an innocent human life intentionally. It is not the same thing when you say we should do things to enable these lives to flourish, where you're talking about a positive act rather than prohibiting an act. You see what I'm saying? So those are do not bind in the same way always and everywhere. They depend much more on circumstances, and there can be some circumstances where you're not obliged to do it. It might be a good idea to do it, but you're not obliged to do it. So the natural law, above all, is concerned with these negative prohibitions that kind of act as the kind of guardrails for the human community, rather than, you know, whereas it would be much more the positive law, which would specify the positive obligations of how to respond to something. Now, the other question, or the other part of your question, or what I would hear in your question, which I think is a very interesting question for, like, moral theology or moral philosophy and also political theory, is understanding when is it legitimate to draw a kind of boundary around a community. And it must be legitimate to have, to some degree, some limitation to belonging to the community in order for us to have an idea of a community. I mean, part of the reason why we can talk about the brown community is because it's identifiable, more or less, if you're a student or a faculty member or a staff member at Brown, that you somehow belong to the Brown community. And people who live on the other side of Providence don't necessarily belong to the Brown community. So it is right for the Brown community to legislate for itself and maybe even to control the terms on which people come in or depart from the Brown community. And that's not unjust. It's just a matter of the nature of the thing. You know, if you're going to have a university, you're going to have an admissions committee. And you can't admit everybody. When you're talking about a political community, it's not that much different. It does make sense that a community can include or exclude some people. The question is doing that in a just way. And, you know, there may be extraordinary circumstances where someone is, their life is in danger and you should give them shelter. Doesn't necessarily follow that you give them membership, like enduring membership in the community. So actually, this is another point where just my experience living in Switzerland was illuminating for me. You just see how other countries do it, and they do it in a very different way than we do. In Switzerland, they do not have a rule that if you are born there, you are a Swiss citizen. I mean, for Americans, that's very strange. But for the Swiss, you have to be Swiss in order to be a Swiss citizen. I mean, you have to become a Swiss citizen. Now, you don't have to be ethnically Swiss. There can be a process for admitting people. They allow refugees into the country, but they do not give them citizenship. Now, that creates other problems, of course, because then you have people living in the community who don't have a say in the governance of the community, and maybe at some point that becomes a problem. But in any case, those are, you know, it. The way we do it is not the only possible way. Father Albert?
It seems like there can be a tension between communities being responsible for promoting and fostering the common good and the flourishing of members, with the fact that individuals are also, in some sense, responsible for their own flourishing. How far does a community, how far ought, well, this might vary by context, but I guess the gist of my question is, how responsible is the community for promoting the common good? Specifically, like, I guess it's balancing individual liberty with policies that would obviously be good for individuals. For example, like maybe requiring people to complete their secondary education versus setting some sort of age limit after which one is free to drop out. It's hard to see how not completing high school is a good thing for anyone. I guess we could think of cases. But by and large, that's not a policy that's been enforced. We allow people to drop out at a certain age. Could you speak to that?
I think the perhaps the more important question, like contained in your question, is about the nature of the common good and being a little clear, getting a greater clarity on that, which I think that is an extremely important topic that Americans typically don't understand well or have a very thin understanding of the common good. So when Aquinas talks about the common good, he has a much thicker conception of what the common good is. And when you have that kind of conception, then some of these things which we think are paradoxes, you know, like individual liberty versus the common good, start to resolve themselves. Why is that? Because most Americans think of the common good as being like, okay, well, you have a fire department, you have roads, you have common defense, maybe you have, you know, some city parks or something like that. But the common good is not really very explicitly thought of as the good of the flourishing community. It's thought of very much like a private good. It's a private good that somehow belongs to the government or something, you know? But that is not what Aquinas thinks we are talking about when we're talking about the common good. He means the good of the community as a community. And often it has a lot of, you know, somewhat intangible elements. So just to give an example from my hometown, I'm from Seattle. In Seattle, people are absolutely crazy about the Seahawks. And now, I think it may be fading a little bit. They're not having the same winning season, you know. But in Seattle, if you're there on a Friday, they have now, instead of casual Friday, they have what they call Blue Friday, where everyone is supposed to wear a Seahawks jersey to work. And when you go, if you're in Seattle during football season on a Friday, it's like the whole city is wearing Seahawks jerseys. Now, actually, in a place like Seattle where you don't have a lot of commonality in the city for the citizens, having a good football team gives you a sense of civic identity. It's very interesting. When you're standing on the street corner, you have something to talk about with the guy who's waiting for the light to change with you. And everybody does talk about the Seahawks, actually. And what I began to realize is this is an element of the common good. To have like a kind of civic pride in being from Seattle and having a winning sports team, the kind of school spirit, you might say, for a city, that is a part of the common good. Now, we could build much more into that. Like, the common good is not opposed to my private good. My private good is actually includes being a member of this community, so that when the common good is flourishing, I am flourishing insofar as I'm a member of the community. So when the Seahawks are winning, you know, I'm happy because they're my team. It's not like I don't get to share in it, because the good of the community is a higher and nobler good. It's a more extensive good, not just like a piece of the pie, but it's like a good at a higher level. And therefore, it makes sense for individuals to even make sacrifices of what we would call private goods, that is, goods that pertain to them only as individuals, for the sake of the community, insofar as they really see themselves as members of the community. I mean, when a sports team is actually not a bad metaphor here, because an individual, running back, he wants the team to win more than he wants to score the winning touchdown. And or on a basketball team, you know, if you have a ball hog on the team who just cares about his own stats and not about the team winning, he is not a good team player. And we recognize that, you know, that's like a defect in a player. In fact, the real good of the player is to be a part of the team that wins. And sometimes that means passing the ball to someone else who's going to score, which in a certain sense is depriving you of your private good. But it's for the sake of the common good, which is also your good. So Aquinas thinks about the community's good much more along those terms. Like, if an invader is attacking your city and is going to burn it down, you want to go out and fight for your city. And it makes sense for you to even be willing to die for your city, because you identify with the city. The city's good is a part of your good. And so it isn't just like the state is able to command you to lose your life. Although you could think about it that way, but Aquinas would say that's not the best way to understand what's really happening there. Well, thank you all.
Can you clarify something about natural law for me? Is it only absolute to the extent that majority agrees on some basic principles and the rest would be relative?
So the traditional understanding of natural law is actually that it doesn't depend on our recognizing it. So it's already there, as it were, because it's built into the very order of what it means to be a human being and what it means to be a member of the human community. Or what the nature of human communities, the way they always are. For example, that we not kill each other, or that we not steal, that we respect each other's private property, relative, a kind of relative autonomy for individual agents and that kind of thing. Or not lying to each other systematically. That would be another part of what Aquinas would recognize as natural law. Now, you can have some cases where a human community doesn't recognize some of those things, and that would be a defective community, and we would critique them for that. Does that make sense? Am I answering your question?
Yeah, you had said that that the principles remain pretty general. So I'm thinking as they get more and more specific, they would be relative to the community.
That's right, yes. So, for example, we could say lying is wrong, and in general, the law should discourage lying. Okay, fine. Should the law outlaw you lying to your mother? Well, I think Aquinas would say, no, that wouldn't be a good law to make, because it would be, even though it wouldn't be unjust, it would probably be unwise to try and bring civil magistrates into your family relationships about, you know, trying to enforce whether kids are lying to their mothers or whatever, you know. And so, similarly, there are some evils that can sometimes be tolerated by the law, because to eradicate them would produce an even greater disorder. So the medieval example of this actually was prostitution, which Aquinas certainly thinks is always wrong and a grave sin. But he thinks that a city might permit it in some circumstances because it would be worse to try and stamp it out. Now, I'm not sure that I would agree with that judgment, actually. But if you go to Freiburg, in where I lived, which is a Catholic canton, there's no separation of church and state. There's the street that is the medieval, it's still the medieval street where the brothels are, and they're still there, and they are legally, prostitution is legal there, actually. Now, I find that terrible. But that's a case where you perhaps have some debate. I mean, legalized drugs would be another case. That's something that would be more debated in the U.S. Like, are the drug laws okay? Yes, drugs are bad. We can see that, like, heroin really destroys people's lives. Does marijuana destroy people's lives in the same way? Well, maybe it's a gateway drug. Maybe it does to some degree. Maybe it would be worse to outlaw marijuana, you know, the effects would be worse than permitting it as a kind of tolerated evil. Those are questions that different communities could disagree about. And I think Aquinas would recognize that even though smoking marijuana is morally wrong, and I would argue for that position, I think Aquinas would hold it. Certainly the Catholic tradition would, contemporary Catholic teaching would say that taking drugs like that, this mind altering intoxication, is always wrong because it's depriving you of the good of reason. Nonetheless, the law doesn't always have to forbid every case of that. So different communities can come to different judgments about that. But that's not a question of transgressing fundamental precepts like killing the innocent. Yes?
Can I ask, as I think, because it's so complicated?
Yes.
So, like, according to Martin Luther King, a law is just if it aligns with the natural law. So, for example, if, like, in country A, you're taught that you should put your, like, if you're put in a situation where you have to either save your parents or a king, you should save your parents first because you're relational. And in country B, you're taught that you should save the king because he's like the king. Then, like, there are like these variations, but I guess the natural law would be to save someone, like, and that is agreed in both countries, even though like they technically have different laws, but those are not like natural laws. So with Martin Luther King, like, as the natural law would be to not harm another human being, to not kill another human being, but in like 1963, when the people who were making the laws for the society probably doesn't think that black people are part of the common. So do you think like that could be justified by the white people that, well, this is just laws in that society because they don't believe that black people are part of the common? Do you get it?
Yes, I think I see what you're saying. I mean, the first example that you gave are examples of where you have a difficult, you might even call it a situation of sort of perplexity, where you've got conflicting goods and you cannot, you know, you can't save everybody on the ship that's going down, and you have to decide who's gonna be saved. The real problem there, the real evil, is being caused by the fact that the ship is sinking, not by your choice. So you're put in a kind of impossible situation, and there you have to do the best you can. And people, there will be disagreements about, you know, which is the higher priority. And I'm not sure that natural law would necessarily give you an answer to that. Aquinas does have something to say about whether you should love and do more good for your parents or like the king. He actually does explicitly talk about this. And he says, you should love your parents more insofar as they are closer to you and they are the principle of your being. So he says, you actually can never adequately repay your parents because they gave you your very life. So without them, you would not even exist. So in a way, you owe them always more than you could ever give them back. That's a very strong claim for parents. Parents like to hear that. So you should call your mother, you know, in other words, when you go home tonight and tell her how much you love her. But you love the king in a different way. He's farther away from you. He is the principle of unity for the political community. So he has a kind of eminence. He's higher than your parents, but he's not as close to you as your parents. So Aquinas would say, now this is not necessarily his natural law teaching. This is his account on, like, he does think that it's okay to love some people more than others. He thinks that you love the people who are close to you more than you love the people who are far away from you. Not that you don't love them, but that you love them as far away. You're always willing to do good to them, but you actually should do more good to the people you encounter and the people who are close to you, because they're the people you can actually do something for concretely. Have I answered your question? I guess the other part of your question was about what to do in a case where someone says, well, these persons are not in fact real persons and therefore don't deserve the protection of the law. And I think Aquinas would not mince words with that situation, you know, and say, if they are rational animals, they are human persons who are equal before God. And he says that very explicitly, Aquinas does, in many places. So Aquinas would have no point of agreement with the position that different races are lesser humans or something like that. In fact, even the category of race is a much more modern one than you find in Aquinas. I mean, Aquinas just doesn't... That's not a relevant category when talking about moral matters for Aquinas, which is an interesting fact that it becomes it's a much more modern, I think, category for moral, you know, making moral distinctions. I don't think a valid one. But you do have today, in the abortion debate, questions over what constitutes a human person. And there I am certainly very pro-life on this position, as would the Catholic position in general, that here we are talking about individuals who are rational animals, individuals of the human species, and therefore there's in principle no reason why you should not call them. In fact, in principle, you should and must call them human persons, and therefore give them that protection of the law, even before they're born. But of course, that's hotly debated. But interestingly, if you were to read the debates over this with respect to slavery between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas, these are famous, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, famous debates that happened in 1858, when Lincoln was running for the U.S. Senate. So this was 2 years before he was elected president. The debates were precisely about whether the law could refuse to acknowledge slaves as human as full persons. And Douglas's position was, let each state decide. Let the majority vote and decide who counts as a person. And Lincoln's claim against that was, if you do this, you destroy the very central principle of self-government. It's the one thing that a democracy can never do, is decide that certain people are not persons. And in fact, if you were to go back and reread those debates and change the words instead of slavery and make it about abortion, it mirrors exactly our contemporary debate about abortion. Because Stephen Douglas's position is precisely, he's literally in favor of leaving the choice to the state rather than saying these are all persons and therefore they all have to be protected by the law. And it is not something that can be left to someone's choice. So I think that's a very, important principle in our history, which is now the subject of a very heated debate. Well, thank you very much for coming out and engaging in this conversation tonight. It's a pleasure to be with you.